Okay, thank you very much indeed. Let me see if I go back. No other... it's okay, I've got it here, thanks. No Other Gospel is the title we've been given as an introduction to the book of Galatians. And I suppose for most of us, Galatians is a book that we'll have read many times. If you've read the Bible through, obviously you'll have read Galatians. If you haven't read the whole Bible, you've probably read large chunks of the New Testament. And Galatians will be one of those pieces of the New Testament that you will almost certainly have read. You'll have read the Gospels, have some idea about Jesus' life, the Acts of the Apostles, some idea about what happened next. And if you've ventured into the letters, Galatians isn't very far into the list of letters before you get there. And so we face a problem, really, in that I suppose in many ways Galatians is quite a familiar book to us, and yet we're going to spend some time looking at it in more detail. We also have a problem in that some people like to get straight on with the book, and some people like an introduction. Some people like to sort of know what the book's about, when it was written, perhaps, who it was written to, who were these Galatians or whatever. And so whatever you do, some people will be happy with what's happened, and some people will be a little bit disappointed that it hasn't quite gone the way that they've wanted to go. When I'm trying to find my way into something, I do like this piece of poetry from Rudyard Kipling. I keep six honest serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when and how and where and who. And I don't know whether you've read the Just So stories that Kipling wrote. He wrote a series of stories, and one of them was called The Elephant Child, and it's a story about how the elephant got its trunk. But he begins each of his of these books, these stories, with a little piece of poetry. And this is the first four lines of what's actually a much longer poem that's quite funny at the end. So it's worth going and digging it out and just having a look. But it's about the inquisitiveness, really, of children, and pointing out that those things that we're always asking, the what's and the why's and the when's, are quite useful ways of learning. And I've found often at work, when I'm looking to try and create some kind of a framework in which to understand things, that these six questions are very often an effective way to try and get a hold of almost any topic. The other good thing about Rudyard Kipling is he died more than 70 years ago, so he's out of copyright. So you don't have problems with Rudyard Kipling's material these days. Why is perhaps an interesting question for us to begin with. Now, there's all kinds of why questions that we could ask about the book of Galatians. Let's just begin by asking ourselves, why are we studying it? And I suppose the simplest reason for that is that sometime last year, when the people who preach and who lead worship, when we all got together, one of the requests was that we should do some more sort of straightforward New Testament theology. We should spend some time thinking about what it is that we believe and where it is in the Bible that it's written down about our beliefs. And so out of that, somebody else asked that we might do some more of the fighty bits, the sort of the men bits, the bits that appeal to courage and stuff. And you'll notice that in the mornings, we're looking at David's life, looking at some of the elements of perhaps the more martial elements of a view of faith. Why was Galatians written? If we'd have started with the what question, and I'm not going to go through all six questions, I'm just trying to find a way in to the book. But if we'd have started with the what question, of course, most people in this room probably know that Galatians was a really important book as far as Martin Luther was concerned. Galatians and Romans were the two books that really transformed his view of what it meant to be a Christian, what it meant for God to save us and to turn our lives around. And his commentaries that he wrote on Galatians and on Romans revolutionized and transformed his view of what God was trying to do in his life, and actually spurred on with the lives of others that had been changed, but did a huge amount to change the whole face of Christendom and in particular starting with Christianity in Germany. So a very, very influential book. But why was it written? Why does Paul begin by writing this book? I just want to leave that hanging for a little bit, because some of the other questions sort of all come together. These questions don't sort of disentangle themselves particularly easily. When is perhaps an easier question, because in chapter 2, he begins, and I'm not going to nick other people's sort of passages. Other people are going to have to deal with these passages. But we do, as far as the timing is concerned, have to look at this, where Paul explains about a time in Jerusalem when the church went through quite a difficult argument over how you became a Christian, and in particular, whether to become a Christian, you had to become a Jew first and then become a Christian, and how much of that Judaism you would have to retain in order to become a Christian. And Paul's argument was that Christianity was something that was completely different. It built on Judaism, but you didn't have to go through it in that sense. And in particular, he argued that many of the outward forms of Judaism, the fasting, the feasting, the sacrifices, and all of those things, they were not necessary to knowing forgiveness with God. And he alludes to that particular, event at the beginning of chapter 2. And if we turn to Acts 15, and particularly if we look at the end of Acts 15, that probably is about as close as we're going to get to at least putting an earliest date on when Paul wrote this letter. So at the end of chapter 15, if you look on page 1111, what a fantastic number, 1111, page 1111, there's a letter that the churches, the apostles, and the elders at the church in Jerusalem write to the newly formed churches around the world that were springing up. And they write a letter, and then verse 30, so men were sent off and went down to Antioch, where they gathered the church together and delivered the letter. The people who read it were glad for its encouraging message. Then it says, verse 33, after spending some time there, Judas and Silas, who themselves were prophets, said much to encourage and strengthen the believers. After spending some time there, they were sent off by the believers with the blessing of peace to return to those who had sent them. But Paul and Barnabas remained in Antioch, where they and many others taught and preached the word of the Lord. Sometime later, Paul said to Barnabas, let's go back and visit the believers in all the towns where we preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing. So actually, in the end, Paul and Barnabas don't go off together. Paul goes off with Silas, and Barnabas takes his cousin or his nephew, John Mark, who's a relative of his, the person who wrote Mark's gospel, and he and John Mark go off on their own journey. So this is some time after Paul's first missionary journey. Paul says it's 14 years after he first went to Jerusalem, and that wasn't immediately after he was converted. So we're talking, it depends on exactly when Jesus died and rose again, but we're sort of talking, I suppose, early 30s, around AD 30 for that. There's about another 17 years at least. So there's a sort of coming up on maybe 20 years after the church first came into being. Paul sets out, so that gives us a when. Why is he doing it? Well, he's following up this letter that has said, actually, you don't have to become a Jew in order to become a Christian. You don't have to make sacrifices. You don't have to keep the Old Testament law in that particular way in order to become a Christian. And part of what Paul has decided to do is to go around the churches again. And it's probable, he can't have written it any sooner than that because he refers to that in his letter, but sometime after that, he writes this letter. So where and who did he write it to? And you say, well, he wrote it to the Galatians, didn't he? But who were the Galatians? Who were these people? And there are two sets of ideas about where these people were living. Basically, we're on the right-hand side of that map. And the churches that Paul had established are basically just above the sea there. They're sort of down to the south of that landmass that's Asia Minor over on the right-hand side of that map. Those people would have been Galatians, not because that was the main bit of Galatia, because actually the bit that was called Galatia tended to be mainly further north. And the problem you have is that people were called Galatians for one of two reasons, either because of their ethnic origins or because of where they were actually living. Today we do some similar things. We have some people, often we will call people ethnically, we'll relate that to where they originated in the world, even though they may not have been born there. If you ask Lorraine, you've worked out that she's sort of got an unusual accent, and you say, obviously you came from the States, what background do you come from? And she'll say, I'm Italian. Now, I don't know that anybody living in Lorraine's family actually lived in Italy, okay? But Americans tend to track back their origins to the bit of Europe that they came from. The Irish are the most, perhaps the worst offenders in this sense. People who've never held an Irish passport, never spoken Gaelic, but they say, we're Irish, okay? And that's because their predecessors came from Ireland. And the Galatians, it's the Gauls, essentially, had spilled over from Europe into Asia Minor, and the Gauls, the people like people who live in this part of the world, maybe not quite this far north and west, but certainly from France and other places, sort of migrate, and there's this sort of moving in from Europe, and they become the Galatians. And the top part becomes known as Galatia, but a lot of people were referred to as Galatians because of their Gallic origins. And depending on which of those you go for, you have an earlier or a later date. But they can't vary that much because Paul was executed probably in the 60s sometime. And if you add on the sort of 17 years, not much can have happened much earlier than the late 40s. So somewhere between the late 40s and the late 50s, this letter was probably written. What I wanted to sort of share a little bit of and was a sort of a personal take on the book of Galatians. One of the things that I wanted to try and do that I haven't managed to do yet is to think a little bit about the church from an information point of view. Organizations share their beliefs and other things according to how they can communicate. These days we talk about knowledge economies. We talk about organizations that are bound together because of what people know. If you're in a bank, there's a lot of information has to be spread through that bank so that people understand. Customers' information, information on investments, all kinds of stuff goes through, and we have a large knowledge economy, and we have companies, huge companies in the world today, who do nothing at all but furnish evidence and information and the equipment through which information is disseminated for other companies. Computer companies, SAP, Oracle, groups like that, just shifting data around for other people. And in a sense, a church is a knowledge economy. It's all about who you know and what you believe. In fact, it is in many ways the purest form of a knowledge economy. The second thing about the church that's really surprising is that it's a distributed organization. It's quite easy to spread information around if everybody's together. If everybody's in the same place, you can have quite an easy job with your knowledge economy. Something happens and somebody tells everybody about it. The thing about the church, the really interesting thing to me, is that the church spread very, very quickly. And the question that I have, you know, they didn't have email. They didn't have telephones. They didn't have mobiles. They didn't have texting. They didn't have any of those kind of communications. And yet somehow you get this group of people who all believe the same thing, and they're spread across hundreds and hundreds of miles. And most of them never see the other person. How do they manage to preserve that sort of knowledge and to spread it around? One of the things I wanted to do in my research, I found there was somebody whom I used to work with, and she was really struggling to find some work that she wanted to do. And she sort of got close to a sort of a faith view of life at one stage. And she said, I'd like to do something that links my work with my faith. And I thought, well, it would be quite fun to look at the early church as a knowledge organization, to think about how they exchanged knowledge and information. What happened? How did that information flow? And unfortunately, she decided to go and do something else. She went off, in fact, to a convent and stayed there for a year. And then that didn't work out. And she went off to another university. So I'm still looking for the student who wants to do something about the church as a knowledge system. The thing is that the church is undoubtedly a knowledge organization. And the really interesting thing about the early church is that these letters that we have were one of the ways in which they communicated what it was that they believed, and they standardized what it was that they believed. If you're going to have an organization that's a knowledge organization and that is distributed, where most of the people will never see the other people in the organization as long as they live, then you need to have two things. One is communication. You need to be able to communicate. And the early church, and this is, I think, quite magical, the way that they managed to make it work. Okay? We struggle to have communication inside our church, okay? And we're all together and we all share the same culture and everything else, okay? The early church managed to smear their knowledge across the known world and to keep moving. Communication is the key. And they did it, as far as I can see, through two means. One was the means was to write letters. And the letters got circulated. Some of the letters tell us that they're not just for this group of people, but they're actually intended to be circulated around groups of people in the environs. And we don't know how many of these letters there were, but a number of them have been collected, and we have them. And they're part of the way in which those people communicate, not just to one another, but to us, and to help us to continue to believe the same things and to reject the same things. It's amazing, isn't it, that 2,000 years later, that is still working with this organization. The other thing that they did was they sent people, mainly, as far as I can see, single men, who gave up a lot of things in order to make dangerous journeys and to travel. It wasn't exclusively men. There are some couples who traveled quite a lot. If you just sit down and try and make a list of everybody that Paul mentions in his letters, there's about 20 or 30 people just who have been associated with Paul in one way or another. It's an amazing number of people. And Paul is often sending them from one place to another. Often the letters go back. Philippians, we know who the person was. Who was the person who took the letter back to the Philippians from Paul? Philemon almost certainly went back at the same time. That's right, because he takes back, I think it was Epaphroditus was the chap, wasn't it? Maybe I've got that wrong. I'll try that. I think it was Epaphroditus. But almost certainly Philemon goes back at the same time, because Philemon is... And these people went, and they sort of became part of the message. They took that message back. And I think this is quite exciting. And I've never had time, really, to sit down and to think about the church, particularly the early church, as an information organization. Most people will agree that this letter was written by Paul. Even skeptics who would challenge a lot of letters that we would say have been written by Paul, most people would regard this one as a genuine Pauline letter. And when they start to sort of work out which letters might or might not have been written by Paul, when they start to look at the words and the phrases and the way in which those go together, they tend to start with Galatians and a few of those others, and they work their way out from there. So there's all the probably less controversy over Galatians than any other book. The other thing is, it's probably the first letter that he wrote, at least that we have. He may have written letters that we don't have, and we don't know whether or how many letters we don't have. That's just something that we don't know. But this is almost certainly, and again, there's a lot of agreement about that Galatians was an early book, even by people who wouldn't necessarily believe the gospel, people who would be quite critical about the way that the letters were written. They would probably say that this was the first of the genuine letters that were written by Paul. So it seems to be tied to this event in Jerusalem, where Christians had to thrash out why they believed, what they believed, and the extent to which you became a Christian through keeping the law and making yourself righteous before God, or the extent to which you accepted something that Jesus gave you by faith. I think that's quite exciting. I think it's quite an exciting book, and it's not surprising that a book like that, one of the very first letters that gets written, is trying to distill the essence of what it means to be a Christian. Okay, Paul is trying to make sure that these little groups that he's put out there, that these groups continue to believe the truth as he sees it. And that's really important, because Paul is absolutely clear that this is not just his idea. He's not setting up his own sort of church. And we can see that one of the things he's keen to do in this letter is to link his ministry to those who were not Jews, to run it parallel to Peter's ministry, who was the apostle who was seen as the one who took the gospel primarily to Jewish groups. Tremendous emphasis by Paul that this is something that God has given. This isn't a man's idea. This is God's idea. Galatians is around, in English, the translations that we use, it's around 3,100 words long. And I guess, as we think about information, if you had 3,000 words to write, 3,000 words that you hoped people might still be reading in 2,000 years' time, to explain what it was that it meant to be a Christian, what would you write? What would you put down? This sort of question has been going around in my head as I've thought about it, because the first agreement that God made with people, a lot of stuff got written down about that. I don't know how long Leviticus is in words. Leviticus is about four and a half times as many chapters as Galatians. So let's say it's 4 to 5 times longer, a much longer book. Most of what's written down there is about ritual. It's about the things that you do. The idea is that you will become shaped by the things that you do. Large tracts of the Pentateuch are taken up with ritual, that you are what you do eventually. Exodus, we think of that as a history book. About half of Exodus is this stuff about building a tent and the measurements of the tent. And 3 different times it's written down how that tent is built. It's told us once when Moses gets the revelation up on the mountain. It's a second time when they actually build the stuff. And we get it a third time in the same book when they assemble it all together and they put the whole thing together and they put the tent together. Words were hard in those days. Words were difficult. They were expensive. Postage. When I sent out my Christmas cards, ones that went abroad, I think were nearly £2 each. I thought that was expensive. But that's nothing like as expensive as it was to send the letter back to the Galatians. One person gives up, 6-8 weeks of their life to take the letter by hand. I don't know how long it took to write it down, but every word was painstakingly written down. I don't know whether any of you are watching some of these historical programs. There's one about a castle going on at the moment where there's some people building a castle in France. And just the other day, last night, the night before, I can't remember which, there was somebody, I think it was on Coast, there was a thing on St. Cuthbert and about the monks in Lindisfarne. And the time that they took writing out by hand, words were so expensive. And they were saying, what happened when you got towards the end of a page and you made a mistake? And they said, you broadened your vocabulary, you left it alone, you went off, you let it dry, you came back the next day, and then you scraped the skin to get that word off, and then you carried on. And they were saying how writing those words, somebody had written down all of the things it did to you. Said it hurt your kidneys and it forced your chest down and it made your tummy hurt because you were against this bench the whole time and it made your eyes water and all kinds of things. Words were expensive. They're cheap for us. If I get on a computer, I can probably write, I don't know, 750, 1,000 words an hour if I'm feeling inspired. I sat one day and I just copied down all the new words I'd written, all of the emails I'd sent out that day, and not even the bits of, if anything was the same, I didn't count that. So all of the new bits of text I wrote, and it was about 5,500 words. Words are cheap for us. We can type fast. They're slow for them. They're expensive. 3,500 words. What is it going to say? What's it going to tell us that's really going to be important? And of course, with words being expensive, that makes you think a lot more about what you're going to put in there. So what is in there? What is this letter about? And it's certainly not about ritual. It's not like the first time God started to write stuff down. It's not about what you do. If there's an R, it's probably relationship. But I'm not sure that it all fits together quite like that. But he doesn't write about the things that you need to do. The first 10 verses are the ones that we're going to look at very quickly tonight. And then we'll try and see afterwards, we'll try and sort of expand that out and look at what's coming next. As I said, one of the first things that Paul is absolutely convinced about, and this has been a challenge for me as I've been thinking about the book, it comes from God. It's not a man's idea. Now, of course, that runs completely counter to everything that we pick up from the world around us. It's counter on two grounds. First of all, people are not that convinced that there is a God who can reveal things. That most of the theories about religion and stuff are that people sort of make them up, that we make God in our own image. That's the sort of the current secular view about where religions come from. And this goes against that. And the other thing is that there are so many religions, they must all be roughly the same. And I think one of the biggest challenges, one of the biggest difficulties that we will face as Christians is that people will give up trying to make any kind of distinctions between different types of faith and trying to find out anything about them. They'll just say all of them are the same. They all make unreasonable demands. They all produce extremists. They all get people to think in a very illogical way. And that's the sort of the world in which we... And we can take that on at times. And we can think about this as being our faith in the sense that it's our particular faith. Not so, says Paul. This has come from somewhere else. This has come from God. This is something that we should take out into the world because it comes from God. And then there's a little chunk in here where he sort of gives you like a thumbnail of what this gospel is. If you want the gospel in a very short, a very, very condensed form, it's that Jesus Christ gave himself for our sins to rescue us from the present evil age, according to the will of our God and Father. If you want the gospel in just a few words, that's it at the start of Paul's writing. When I used to write reports, I got a boss who came in from outside, And he used to say to me, Terry, he said, you guys write reports completely wrong. He said, you write all of this massive stuff that nobody wants to read, all of this learned stuff and the references and everything else. He said, that's not how you should write a report. He said, you should write a report the way a newspaper writes its articles. So the first thing is you have a headline, and that says in about five words what the article is about. So when you're looking at the newspaper, you can just tell at a glance whether you're going to read that article or not. He said, and then if you read, you'll find that the first paragraph is a complete summary of the rest of what's been written. He said, and then you'll find out that the next two or three paragraphs explode that, and then if it's a longer article, then the next column or whatever will be a more detailed version. So they keep telling you the same thing over and over again in more and more detail. And he said, that's the way I want you to write. When you send me a report, I want one like that. He said, I want one page at the front that tells me everything I need to know about your report. And if you can get a title that tells me everything about it, so much the better. And in a sense, that's what Paul has done here. He's in that first paragraph, he tells us that the gospel is about the fact that Jesus Christ gave himself for our sins. As we read the book, we should expect to find something about sins. One of the best courses I ever went on was a speed reading course. I'm naturally quite a slow reader. When I was a kid, probably all of them, read a lot more than I ever read when I was growing up. I think Nathan must read hundreds of pages a week. I might have read hundreds of pages in a year, maybe, and I'm not even that. I did very little reading when I was growing up, and I tended to read my Bible and a few bits and pieces, but I wasn't a great reader, and I didn't particularly enjoy reading, and I'm kind of naturally quite a slow reader. And I managed to go on this speed reading course once, which was terrific. And over the course of 2 days, my speed of reading went up from about 200 words a minute to about 600 words a minute. And I'm not sure it sustained at that rate, but what it taught me was that you can read at different speeds. But one of the keys to good reading is to have questions in your mind about what the rest of the page is going to be like. And the person told us, you know, when you look at headings, look at headings and get them to get you to ask questions. And as you skim through trying to read something quickly, try and get up some questions that this may provide you with answers to. And here Paul is giving us some of the key words that we ought to be expecting in this book will be important. Sins will be important. Rescue will be an important concept in this whole book. How is it that God plans to rescue us from the lives that we're living? Or, as it says here, from the present evil age. The world's a dangerous place, says Paul, and God's plan for you and for me is that we should be rescued. How are we going to be rescued? Well, we're going to read on. We're going to find out later on in Galatians how we're going to be rescued. One of Paul's concerns is that there isn't, just as in our day and age, Paul recognizes that there are other gospels out there. When he talks about other gospels, he's probably thinking quite specifically about people who believe that you have to become a Jew before you become a Christian if you weren't born a Jew in order to become a Christian. He's probably thinking about those kinds of people, but he's aware that there are lots of people with ideas about how you sort yourself out, about whether there's a heaven to get to, about how you get into it. Is it by blowing yourself up on a street corner? Is that a shortcut? There are lots of gospels out there. There were lots of gospels in his day and age. There were people who were very philosophical about it. There were people who would fight about it too. There were all kinds of ideas. And Paul says there are other gospels. And his challenge to the Galatians and the way in which it fits with this business about how you become a Christian is that he's saying you've drifted. And that's a challenge to us 2,000 years later, isn't it? We talk about mission creep, don't we? You start a project off, and 5 years later, you're still doing the same project, only when you look at it, you're doing nothing like what you said you were going to be doing when you started the project, because it's drifted to be something else. Have we drifted? we think of ourselves as people who want to implement what God has told us. To what extent do we really believe what Paul had taught to his first converts and that they believe? Tricky bit, of course, is that if you start to argue about these things, and there's a really interesting example in the next chapter about Paul arguing with Peter, you do tend to end up in fights with other people. How are we going to manage that? Paul simply alerts us to the fact at this stage that sometimes the truth involves conflict with other people. The truth is not just about how I feel about it or how you feel about it. His whole purpose in writing is that we can all share the same sort of knowledge and understanding, and in our case, a relationship with Jesus that allows us to be sure that we actually have the truth and not just that we feel good about what we've got. So what is the gospel? Over the next couple of weeks, next week, I can't read that. I've made that so small, the name of the person there. Sando, who's speaking next week and the week after? Pardon? Okay, John and, pardon? John and Matt. So over the next 2 weeks, they're going to be looking at two of the themes early on. We've already started to see them. One is that this is divinely inspired, that this gospel comes from God. And the second thing is that it enjoys the approval of the apostles in Jerusalem. That's really important. Paul often doesn't go back that far. In terms of justifying his own existence. Probably he was better known as an apostle later on, but at this stage, he's very keen to make the connection between those who knew Jesus and the gospel that he's presenting. So the divine origins and the apostolic approval are two important themes for this gospel. And then I suppose if you thought that there were sort of two themes that you would really associate with Galatians, it's got to be faith and the law. Faith is one of those really important things. How is it that our lives are changed before God? What is this faith stuff? Where does it come from? And what do we do with it? And then a couple of examples about how faith works. Two surprising examples, perhaps, because they come from the secular world in which he lives. One is the child. The child who was going to inherit the estate. But at that stage, the child is too young to inherit. And so although the child owns everything, the child hasn't got the power to do very much. There will be other people until the child reaches his majority who will run it for him. And Paul uses that as an illustration of growing up in the faith. And it's part of the way in which he looks at the law and the role that the law fulfills. And then the slave talks about slavery and about the role that slavery and freedom play in a person's development. Freedom, following on from the slave. And then a couple of talks around, and this is just taking Galatians in the chronological order, in the order in which it's written down. The last two things are about a behavior. How are we supposed to live? Now, it's interesting that Paul doesn't say, look, you guys have got the Holy Spirit, therefore everything's going to be okay. Whatever you feel is going to be right, that's going to be, you'll be okay as a church. He thinks that that's really important. And we'll find he talks a lot about life in the Spirit, okay? But he's also really keen that stuff should be written down and that people should test what it is that they believe against what he has passed on to them. And that ultimately should affect the way that people behave. Most of Paul's letters, you could split them in two. One half, how you should believe, what you should believe, and the second half, how you should apply that in your everyday life. Why should it make a difference? How should it make a difference to the way that you live your life? So, how special is the gospel to us? As I've been reading and preparing for this, it struck me that Paul has a much higher view of the gospel than I tend to relapse into. Paul says this is something which has come from God to change people here on earth, and it really does, says Paul, have cosmic implications. How fast are we spreading it? The first time God got Moses to write stuff down, it didn't really start going anywhere for hundreds of years. The second time, it travels like wildfire. Within about 20 or 30 years, it had moved from an unimportant domain at the periphery of the Roman world to the heart of Rome itself. There were Christians in Rome within 10 or 15 years. And within 300 years, the gospel becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. I'm not going to talk about whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. All I'm saying is it moved like wildfire. What's the gospel doing in our hands? How fast is it moving in our hands? And there's a challenge, I think, as we go through the next few weeks, looking at what Paul's written down, comparing what we really believe with what he wrote down. Have we got the gospel? Are we starting to promulgate another gospel? And that, I think, is a challenge for us. Thanks very much indeed. Back to you, Alan.